Hello and welcome to USSOcast, a US Studies online podcast. In this series, we chat to PhDs and ECRs about their research, their life in academia, and all things in between. Today, I'm lucky to be joined by Carl White, a third-year PhD student at University of Leeds, whose research looks at contemporary literature and financialization. So Carl, welcome. How are you? And I should say, how's your head after presumed celebrations on Wednesday night?
Hello. Hi, well, thanks for having me. I'm good. My head is also quite good. I feel like I was so joyous on Wednesday night when England beat Denmark.
Acted as a buffer for everything else.
Yeah, and I think I just sort of burnt off all the rum I drank, and I sort of didn't wake up with a booze hangover, but a joy hangover. Yesterday was really hard to do any sort of work. It's like trying to read some Lukács. My friend is like, no, not happening.
Very distracted. Great to hear. Do you want to tell us a little bit about your research and, you know, go into as much detail as you'd like to at this point?
So I guess broadly speaking, my interest is in 21st century American literature and what I'm calling neoliberal financialization.
Is that your own coinage?
I mean, they're words that people use already. It's just that like financialization has sort of happened throughout history. So I'm sort of using neoliberal as a kind of historical periodizing term to say like since the 70s, basically in America, that is. But I'm sort of thinking about how the novel specifically represents that change, particularly with reference to the 2007-2008 financial crisis. So I'm sort of thinking broadly about how like value is sort of ascertained or like allotted in these sort of spaces, both in sort of finance and in fiction. I'm thinking about sort of representational logics. Finance is a way of representing value. Fiction is a way of representing stuff more broadly. So I'm thinking about genre. I'm thinking about sort of narratorial logics. I'm thinking about the spaces in which these novels sort of narrate finance taking place, workplaces, households, sort of representing currency as well is a big thing. I'm thinking about how finance kind of flattens an idea of time. And what the US's role in this is as a kind of focal point of global finance with sort of relation to sort of like imperialism, neocolonialism, globalization, those kind of things. So those are kind of like broad areas that I'm looking at basically.
That's excellent. Yeah, I mean, this is such a broad question, and just feel free to bat this away like a mosquito humming around your ears. But why like finance? Because it's so interesting to me. Like, it's a really unique hook and focalizer for, you know, taking post-70s American lit. And, you know, in the American Studies networks we have online and stuff, and the people I spoke to, not really something I've seen come up, which is why it's, you know, it's unique, and I'm kind of glad to talk to you about it.
Yeah, I guess. Basically, because, well, also, like, loads of people talk about capital, right? And like, obviously, finance is part of that. So that all of that stuff sort of is sort of imbued within my research and forms a lot of my sort of broader thinking. But finance specifically, I guess, is there's a lot of crossover with sort of the way novels represent things as well. And I guess that's kind of what I'm interested in. And it is sort of these ideas of space and time being constructed, molded by finance is sort of a similar kind of logic to the novel. I mean, it's sort of an emergent field as well. Sort of since maybe about 2014, 2015 is kind of when finance became a sort of specific thing that people started looking at as opposed to more broad sort of capital or neoliberalism. Those things still exist and that work is still really, really valuable. But finance is, I guess, sort of like a narrower way of looking through these texts. And I guess that's kind of
the thing.
I mean, it was a complete sort of non-academic accident that kind of led me to it, basically, as a lot of these things are.
Were you someone who already had a bit of a kind of economic inclined mind in the way you kind of looked at your worldview was kind of influenced by that? Or was it just kind of something you thought, this sounds pretty interesting, let's go for this? It seems so kind of alien to me, just someone who like knows very little about finance and capital and was terrible at maths. Like, I'm in awe of you being able to kind of balance this different school of thought.
So I guess the first part of the question, I didn't know anything about finance, and arguably still don't. I don't think the financiers really know what finance is either, and that's sort of part of what's interesting about it is is that these novelists are also trying to understand finance and use sort of like, you know, metaphor and metonym at the most sort of like at the sentence level to try and understand what finance is and how the language of finance itself is sort of obfuscating and obscuring these ideas of like value and the sort of materiality of what happens, I guess, surrounding it. Yeah, I had like no economic inclinations. I mean, I'm not, the way my brain works is quite analytical as opposed to creative. And I was like quite good with like numbers and stuff in school, but I found it very boring. No, I came to this just because like what I originally proposed for my PhD got me into the uni, and then within like 2 months me and my supervisor were like, there's not a lot here. What are you actually interested in? And it turned out that it just sort of morphed into something else basically. Here we are sort of, but I end up changing my entire PhD at like Christmas of first year.
I mean, so many people report doing that anyway, that's kind of the norm, isn't it? It's expected. Weirdly, I actually think my proposal, what I've written up to now, you know, after these 3 years, it is almost like to the letter what was in the proposal, and that that seems really like
what foresight
that feels wrong. It just feels like, no, it's like just you've got no creativity here. Like I just had no sudden burst or light bulb moments as I was going across the 3 years, and I feel like I've missed a trick there. I don't know.
Nah, just think it's like you're amazing at writing proposals and knowing what future you is going to think about.
Not it. But yeah, I was interested what you just said about kind of finance, the jargon of finance, kind of obfuscating, you know, reality and things. I just think that's a really interesting way of putting it and looking at how that's represented in novels and stuff. How, I guess, real world and fiction is kind of that, you know, it's so manipulative in its rhetoric, I guess. You talked about kind of finance flattening time as well. I'm really interested in that. What kind of like temporalities and how they shift in what you look at. So could you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, I guess so. I guess the first part of that about the sort of like jargon and stuff, a lot of these novels sort of avoid that too. It kind of like doesn't, it's not like these novels are sort of going around saying like the collateral debt option of this meant this. Like there are a couple of novels that do that, and I do look at a couple of them because that's sort of an exception. But it's also like an exception, right? Like fundamentally these novels are trying to like be sold in a sort of literary marketplace, and no one's going to read that shit. and from what I've gathered on these novels that do that, they don't sell well, and they're not great. Aesthetically, they're not great. But in terms of like the second part of your question, the sort of time and temporalities thing, there's, God, this is me going to try and recall critical theory now, because theory is not how my brain works.
Likewise, you're in like, good company, in terms of theory. So
give me novels and stuff, I can remember them. Films can do it. Music can do it. Cannot, for the life of me, remember more than one piece of theory one time.
You're literally preaching to the choir. It's so nice to hear that from another PhD.
Yeah. So the temporary thing, the one that I sort of generally go to is Maurizio Lazzarato, who's like an Italian, sort of like financial sort of Marxist guy, sort of writing sort of like sociological stuff basically. And the sort of temporality thing with finance is all sort of surrounding debt, and it's the sort of idea that you can hold someone in debt, you sort of control the power relation of the future. So if for companies and people with money, especially, and so this is why it's like a sort of capitalist formation, is that you, the way you make money is by sort of minimizing risk. Financial stuff is inherently risky, but there's more profit to be made. So if you want to sort of minimize the risk of the future, but make the most money possible, you control that future option through the present, and you do that by holding people in debt. So that's why there's like an increase of like, and like, I mean, he's writing in like 2007-ish and 2011, but even since then, you can see the like proliferation of like, you know, buying a car on like a finance option. You pay like per month. So it's like the company knows they've got X amount of income, or they hold you in like a legal, like, I don't know, you're beholden to them, right? Same with like mortgages. And like, this is what caused the financial crisis, is that people who couldn't pay the mortgages were like given mortgages, basically. And the debt was valuable in and of itself. That could be sold on. That was the idea that these companies could still make money. So it's that kind of idea of controlling a power relation of the future through the sort of present financial. which is why finance can be like really interesting, because it kind of mixes this, like, I don't know, it's kind of a cliche to say that like Marxian and like Foucauldian thought are like at opposite ends. I never thought they really were anyway. But I feel like reading finance sort of like just sort of shows that there's these things are sort of intertwined, right? And there's not like separate schools of thought. You can think about the materiality, and you can think about these kind of like abstract ways of like political governance and private sector governance.
Yeah,
they're together.
Yeah, this is just so interesting to me because it's so kind of out of my wheelhouse, which is, you know, everyone who's come on the podcast really is doing something that's very much out of my wheelhouse. So it's just so nice to kind of hear what you're working on. I mean, there's a book that's just come out by a lecturer at my uni, Luke Kennard. I don't know if you follow him on Twitter or stuff.
No, I don't. I don't know.
Maybe. Who knows who we follow on Twitter?
I can't remember anymore. Yeah.
It's called The Transition, and it's set in the UK in kind of a very, very near future. You know, or might even be contemporary, with just a slightly kind of shifted alternate reality. But that's all about kind of like the housing crisis and mortgages and people not being able to afford mortgages. And it's this kind of darkly comic dystopia where people are kind of flat sharing and renting in like a really strange, I can't quite explain. I've not read the book yet, but they're like, just from what the reviews I've read and kind of seeing it publicized, it sounds like it's doing something interesting with kind of, you know, contemporary financialization and making that into kind of a slight dystopia, which might be of interest to you. Obviously it's not American lit, but
sounds cool.
Something to think about. You've kind of touched on these a little bit, but could you talk about some of the primary materials you're looking at, you know, some of the texts that you're working on and
why
you selected those and perhaps why you've had to leave others by the wayside, because this is something I'm constantly wrestling with.
Why
am I not looking at Faulkner, for example, or something like that? So, you know.
Sure. Yeah.
Go for it.
So I guess, I don't know, probably the most, the ones that people probably know most readily that I sort of write about are like, I've written about Jennifer Egan's A Visit from the Goon Squad, is part of this thesis. I've written about David Foster Wallace's The Pale King, Colson Whitehead's Apex Hides the Hurt, is a really interesting novel, I think. And, you know, controversially, I think it's Colson Whitehead's best novel.
Really? I've only read like The Colossus of New York, so I'm not going to be able to like refute your claim, so it's fine.
Yeah. It's probably just because like I find it interesting for what I'm doing. I mean, I actually haven't read The Nickel Boys yet, so maybe that'll be the one. Apex Hides the Hurt's really funny. The sort of like average middle of the road ones that talk quite openly about like housing and finance and mortgages. Martha McPhee's Dear Money, Jess Walter's The Financial Lives of the Poets. So I guess sort of I'm looking at kind of like a broader range of these texts to kind of do a kind of like, my idea for the thesis is a kind of like survey thing, basically just sort of saying like, well, why do novels talk about finance and in what ways do they do it? There's a lot of scholars currently sort of are sort of tied to genre. So a lot of the really good books that have come out recently are sort of saying like, how do realist texts talk about finance and use finance as a way of sort of thinking about realism more broadly. So they're thinking in those terms. Whereas I'm kind of like less tied to those kind of ways, because genres are increasingly blurred when talking about finance. And also that work has already been done. So I'm not going to sort of like, what about dystopias? Like people are writing on that stuff, or what about realist fiction? People write about that stuff. But what's interesting is that sometimes these fictions are kind of doing all of the genres all at once. And it's like, all right, what the hell's going on here?
Yeah. How do I unpack this? It's a really great selection of primary materials, I think. The closest text I'm trying to think that I've read that kind of touches, you know, the outside of what you're doing was probably And Then We Came to the End by Joshua Ferris.
That's an interesting novel.
That's obviously all about like white collar work and, you know, office life. And
That did get left by the wayside. I did think about putting it in.
That was one that was in contention for you.
Yeah, it was. And particularly with the like second person narration, it's like, so for those that haven't read it, it's almost like the first person narration. Is it first person plural? Isn't it actually? Sorry, it's not second person.
So it's we.
It's we all the way through. God, my brain. And so it's like this sort of like homogenous blob of office workers, right? The protagonist. But then as the novel goes on, they get split out and separated, and certain ones do certain things, and it's like becomes more obvious. But they're all the worker almost. I ended up leaving it by the wayside sort of just because I just was already, I'd done more work on a couple of others. You know, maybe it'll be an article later in the future or something. But I think since I started my PhD, there's been a couple of articles have come out on that novel. Yeah, I cannot remember who they're by.
Brian Jansen, maybe?
I feel like I've seen him tweet
recently about that.
And I think there was another one at some point that came out a couple of years ago. But yeah, a really interesting novel. Yeah. I realize I didn't answer your question about other ones left by the way.
You can circumnavigate these questions however you want. They're not the most elegantly posed, but
it's my podcast now, Will. I've been like slaving away on the last year on a novel, but on Lionel Shriver's The Mandibles. I like wrote an article about it that was published in Humanities and came out. And then I was thought that that was like where the direction of this chapter was going. And then it just wasn't. I was trying to write about that and Jesmyn Ward's Salvage the Bones, two completely different novels. But my thinking with that was like, you know, you have the like white middle class, like New York novel, and you have the Mississippi working class black novel essentially. And it's sort of like they're talking about the same things just in very different ways.
Yeah.
And I was sort of interested as to use those two texts to map something in the middle. And I sort of wrote a full draft of it and it just didn't work at all.
Really?
And I was just really frustrated. But so Salvage the Bones is inadvertently, I think, a finance novel, even though it never talks about finance because its protagonist is a 14-year-old who doesn't know about finance, but everything she talks about is related to it. Sort of in the sort of time of Hurricane Katrina, basically. It's an amazing novel and I really want to write about it because I love it so much.
Yeah.
But it just didn't fit. And I was just sort of gutted they didn't fit. It was a real kill the darlings kind of moment.
We have those often, I think.
I know. And The Mandibles is like an infinitely worse novel for so many reasons.
Really? I'm not actually familiar with The Mandibles.
It's Lionel Shriver's. Yeah. She's not great.
She's problematic, I think, in some ways. Yeah.
I hope she doesn't listen to this. Actually, no, I hope she does listen to this podcast. Lionel. If you're listening, I'm coming. I'm going to find you. No, but... that novel is like interesting, I think. Sort of accidentally, maybe, but it's doing like both a speculative fiction thing and also 19th century naturalism at the same time. Loads about like gold. Its idea of a speculative future and like saving America from like a collapsing dollar is to like go on the gold standard. And it's like,
that seems vaguely Randian in kind of philosophy.
Isn't it just? Very libertarian. So it's an interesting novel to have in as sort of like, this is kind of, in genre terms, it's an interesting novel, I think. But I don't know how deliberate it is in what it's doing.
Yeah.
And the novel is like, you know, pretty racist and does all the things that you'd expect a Lionel Shriver novel post We Need to Talk About Kevin to do. It kind of fits with my thesis better than Salvage the Bones does, which is frustrating, I think.
It's great to hear how fruitful this material's been in terms of like producing journal articles and things as well. And you know, even when things don't fit, you know, there's always surplus material. There's these kill your darling moments, you know, keep them to one side and they come in use eventually. This might be a question you can just simply say no to, but I mean, is this work like a continuation of kind of any MA work you did? You know, we kind of talked a little bit about how you came to financialization and kind of economics as a focalizer, but I wonder, had you done anything kind of adjacent to it before, and do you envisage, I mean, this is very premature, but do you envisage any kind of postdoc continuations of this project in any way?
Buckle up, kids, it's story time. So so yes and no, it was a continuation of the master's thing, but only because the master's thing was sort of, I did an extension of the master's thing for my PhD proposal, and then that morphed into what the PhD project like currently is. So my master's, this is weird because the link is not going to be immediately obvious. I did my master's thesis on this, like, on the continuing like image and sort of narrative deployment of the labyrinth in like various texts, right?
Wow, okay.
And so that's what that was, and it was mostly because I was like 21 years old and thought House of Leaves was like the coolest book ever.
Oh,
because I'm a white dude, like that's what happens.
I mean, and weirdly, I'm already thinking of like cubicles in an office as like being immediately like translatable.
Right? Yes. Yeah. So yeah. My thinking was that, that's a text that calls back to like Borges and like mythology. And yeah. I was like, and so my master's thesis was basically like that, like tracing that idea back, and not only sort of spatial labyrinths, but temporal, the idea of sort of temporality, and the idea that like actually in Borges's writing in the 40s, there's like a story, like of an endless library that contains every possible combination of like the English language. And yeah. So the idea almost is that there's a collapsing of temporality there, because everything that is ever written after Borges's book is published is also in the library.
Also there, yeah.
So, and so there's this like complete flattening of time. And so I found that idea of space and time interesting. And I thought that's manifest in this like figure of the labyrinth, basically. Mm-hmm. But then as I was, yeah, the PhD emerged like a couple of months in, I was like,
yeah.
Actually what I'm interested in, yeah, is like sort of these office spaces is like a sort of cityscapes was kind of a big one. Yeah. And I was thinking about like the internet a lot. And like data, I was thinking about all of these things as kind of like contemporary manifestations of labyrinths, right?
Mm-hmm.
That have the same kind of, I don't know, the same sort of effect, I guess, like disorientation and sort of all of that stuff. And then I sort of realized like, maybe it's actually all just the economy.
Yeah.
And that was kind of what happened. and then it led to finance. And that's kind of a charting of where I started and where I ended up.
Yeah.
And why I didn't really know much about the economy and still sort of don't.
Mm.
But I guess what I'm trying to do is sort of say like, well, this is how these novels talk about it. I'm not sort of judging whether they're correct or not in whether they sort of talk about the economy. It's just interesting that they use these spaces to do so. And like, you know, it's not a coincidence that these places are generally a white collar workplace or a kind of heteronormative family in a house that someone owns. You know, there's very few fictions about renters, it seems, that talk about finance explicitly. If someone renting a flat is like part of a novel, it seems to not be a novel about the economy more broadly. So it's always about like ownership, and it's about the job and like the American, it's like the American dream stuff. Reformed basically. And it seems like these novels can only talk a lot of the time can only talk about finance if it sort of starts from that, like, you know, the idea of what like the human in quote marks, you know, the average like white heteronormative family. It has to do that first before we can do the interesting stuff, basically, which is not that. And it feels like there's just like, we're getting there, but it feels like these novels, they have to do the white heteronormative novels first before you can then do other people. It's just this weird like space.
Yeah, I mean, I love hearing the kind of lineage of these projects. And I think, you know, you initially said, oh, this is going to sound completely unrelated at first. But I mean, as soon as you said labyrinth, like my mind went to like New York grids and cubicles and just, you know, exactly where you kind of eventually went as well. And like, it's just, you know, it makes a lot of sense to me that project is born from you know, this kind of really interesting symbol that you were kind of tracing all the way back to, you know, the 40s. And I think that's great. I mean, have you thought about kind of where this project might go in the future at all?
That was another part of your question, wasn't it? I mean, so one thing that I have found doing this project is that it's the sort of like necessary evil of like restricting your research by like national borders. And I imagine also sort of time as well. Like I've sort of said 21st century American literature as a way almost of kind of pinning myself to sort of the financial crisis is like the big obvious thing that links all these texts, but also like, you know, September 11 attacks there, Hurricane Katrina's there. And also the fact that America is, or the US is sort of less obviously a center of financial dealings sort of as time goes on.
Mm-hmm.
And, or at least what we might understand as like, economies more focused on production, like China and Southeast Asia, and a lot of basically the global South, are also part of this financial system. They're just like, and to sort of ignore that is to sort of a problem of reproducing these same kind of power structures.
Yeah.
And so the way I'm sort of thinking of it is just like, well, I want to talk about this idea of like the financial crisis started in the US. So that's my sort of like justification, I guess, for thinking of this stuff. And that is something that in the next like year of writing up this thesis, I'm having to sort of like work out. But yeah, like a postdoc project, I think would be more focused on like world literature and sort of think about the sort of world system stuff that people like the Warwick Research Collective, like Stephen Shapiro, Cherie Descartes are sort of thinking about this stuff. And it's really, really interesting and really valuable for the work I'm doing at the minute. But I think sort of tracing sort of like basically global finance through what we might sort of like crudely call a world literature, including sort of texts from the US and the UK and that kind of thing. But it is a project that I feel is a natural sort of follow on to this
progression. Yeah.
But then the problem comes of like, I'm monolingual, like, and am I the best person to do this project? Like, nah.
Yeah. Who knows?
And yeah. To what extent can you be selfish about doing a project like this? You're like, I'm not sure this stuff is interesting, but if you spoke Spanish and French and probably Mandarin, you'd be in a better place to do this project than I would be, which is a thing I'm sure a lot of people wrestle with.
I completely get those anxieties, but I mean, it sounds like a really kind of exciting, just blooming out of the project at the moment into this kind of, you know, as you say, world kind of literature focus. And you know, it makes sense looking at kind of the path you've been on to get to this point now, to kind of go on to that next step. I mean, it's been amazing hearing about your research. What I normally do kind of the last kind of portion of these episodes is just kind of talk about, you know, the elephant in the room, how COVID has affected, you know, kind of your process and kind of any archive work that may or may not have happened or been cut short, or kind of any, I think you might have something to say on that end. I hope I'm not kind of probing you too hard there. But yeah, how has your kind of process, kind of just daily life as a PhD student, been affected by this in any way? Anything you'd like to kind of share with us?
Yeah, I mean, like annihilated, basically. But not through lack of like access to stuff. Well, I mean, lack of access to my supervisor, basically, but more through just like, I never worked from home ever. I was always like in a library or something, or like in a cafe at like 8:30 in the morning, and then would just like blitz it for 4 or 5 hours and then like crash in the afternoon and read a bit. Whereas COVID meant that I had to just like everything just went a lot slower. And working from home in like a house share with some friends who are also working from home is just like, there's just so much like nervous energy about, basically. So that was hard. The archive work that was cut short. So I was in Austin, Texas, basically like the week before lockdown in the UK. There from like the end of January, and I was due to be there until about mid-May. I'd got a fellowship to be at the Harry Ransom Center, and I was looking at the David Foster Wallace archives, because it's the only place where that stuff is. And I was looking at the correspondence between like him and his publishers and his agent and all of that stuff, and sort of like early drafts of The Pale King. It's an unfinished text. This is an interesting thing. David Herring's book, for instance, is like really cool if anyone's interested in the sort of like genealogy of The Pale King's construction. While I was out there, wind of COVID was coming across the Pacific. And everything just shut like suddenly. Like, it was fine on like the Tuesday, and then on the Thursday it was like, oh no, everything is shut. And Austin was dead. I've like never seen it. I hadn't seen it like that, and it was kind of weird. And then I had to get an emergency flight back, almost didn't get back. I was in the airport on like the Saturday night, and it was just full of people trying to get home, and the plane came in, and then someone was ill on the incoming plane, unspecified illness, in mid-March 2020, bears in mind. And the cleaners at Austin Airport refused to clean the plane. I'm guessing they didn't have medical insurance as part of their presumed minimum wage jobs, which is like fair enough. So the British Airways cabin crew had to deep clean the plane while getting instructions over what was then Skype. No one used Zoom.
No.
Why is everyone using Zoom since Skype? Skype threw that, didn't it? Yeah. but from like someone in London basically telling them how to deep clean a plane properly, and it took ages. But we didn't know about this, so we were just sat in the airport and it was getting delayed by like half an hour. And then I have never felt so proud to be back in Britain.
I can
basically
imagine. Yeah
like shed a tear,
swelling of relief.
Yeah, shed a tear as we descended over the Thames, basically.
Yeah.
And we landed, and the pilot was like, "Yeah, we were lucky to get out of Austin last night."
It's literally like an apocalyptic.
It was
kind
so
of
weird.
Yeah, I can't imagine.
What was almost more weird was getting on the train from London back to Leeds, because I was like, I didn't want to go. My parents live in Nottingham, and I didn't want to. I would have seen them, but I was like, no, I'm just going to go straight to Leeds. And this pandemic thing's weird. And I got on the train, and it was rammed. And like, it was so weird from having been in Austin that was like a week before was dead, and everyone, it was basically locked down, to a full packed train. And I was just like, it was really weird. And then like 5 days later, there was the UK lockdown. Yeah.
It's crazy.
Yeah, it was weird. So when everyone was like, oh, I haven't been to the pub since March 2020, I was like, I haven't been to the pub with friends since January 2020.
Yeah, yeah. You know? No, thank you. Thank you for just being so candid with your kind of experiences there. Because I mean, you know, you have a lot to kind of share in terms of having very kind of a really great fellowship cut short, and you know, being able to share, you know, the experiences of being there. It's, you know, I asked that question to everyone, but you'd really had a lot of kind of solid evidence. Like, here is how COVID kind of ruined.
Yeah.
It. So yeah, I mean, thank you for sharing that. is there anything we kind of haven't discussed that you kind of wanted to bring up, or anything you wanted to ask me or listeners or anything like that? Because we're kind of getting towards the end of things now. We can.
Right. Yeah. If you want to chat, say hi, send me an email.
yeah, you can read your email out by all. I'll put it on Twitter.
Yeah. Stick it in the show notes, however. But stick it in the show notes. The easy one for you to access will be my teaching one at c.white3@leeds.ac.uk.
There you go.
Follow me on Twitter at Carl White, and then 2 underscores, because with 1 underscore was taken.
Classic.
I mean, if you haven't discerned from like the last half an hour, I will just chat to you about anything. I'm pretty easygoing. And keep an eye out for an article that I might be having that's coming out with Textual Practice on Jennifer Egan's A Visit from the Goon Squad, White Collar Work and Capitalist Realism.
Can you give us a bit of a pricey about what we can find in this article? A bit of a slug line.
Oh, basically, I'm looking at how a couple of the sort of like vignettes in the novel, how kind of like global exploitative capitalism is sort of traced through a PR campaign and through to a kind of celebratory concert at the end. And the novel sort of like quite openly, its characters sort of quite openly like elide thinking about it. And so I'm sort of thinking about the sort of like, I guess how the sort of like white US citizen sort of like disavows thinking about the sort of like
market
legacy,
capitalism,
basically,
yeah.
In order to have a good time.
Yeah.
But how the novel is kind of there through that, through sort of reading those moments in the novel, how the novel is sort of deploying sort of capitalist realism as a kind of like almost like a genre of literature in order to kind of move away from an idea that all reality is like necessarily capitalist, or all realism is necessarily capitalist.
Well, that sounds brilliant. Yeah. Textual Practice.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I've been waiting on the proofs for a while. It sounds like there's a long queue.
Really?
So yeah, I mean, I've been waiting for the proofs to come back for a while. So if you're listening, editor.
Well, we look forward to seeing that whenever it might be, and sharing that on Twitter, etc. But yeah, thank you so much, Carl. It's been really lovely to chat to you about your work.
Cheers, Will.
Finally sit down and hear a little bit more about it. If you listening would like to join us on USSOcast, please get in touch with US Studies Online on Twitter and on our website. You can email us USSO@BAS, which is BAAS.ac.uk. And thank you very much for listening. Thank you, Carl.
Cheers. See you later.